Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Percepta Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great one for you tonight. We're going to be following up our discussions regarding the Darkest Dungeon. For the people who have somehow managed to miss it, it is the Lovecraftian RPG game that I have played through. Oh my goodness, I've lost count how many hours I've spent playing through it. But there is now a completed playlist over on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. And my guest tonight is co-founder of Red Hook Games, as well as creative director. Please welcome to the cast, Chris Barassa.
How's it going, man?
It is going great, Chris. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Just trying to pick up the pieces of my personal life after shipping the DLC.
I know. It feels like it's been like years since we last spoke. I think it's only been like, I think we last spoke was like 2016, I think we did something.
Yeah, it's probably been about a year, to be honest. It's been a while.
And time just seems, I guess, keeping with the Lovecraftian themes, time has lost all meaning, I think, for us here.
Yeah, it sometimes feels like that when you're right in the midst of development, kind of days just happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you listening to this cast right now, we're going to be skipping going over kind of what is the Darkest Dungeon and how it got started, as we have certainly spoke about that at length on these podcasts. If I can find the links to them in the archives, I'll put them below. But for today's cast, we're going to be kind of talking about what's happened with the Darkest Dungeon lately. And that, of course, involves the DLC, the Crimson Court, which, again, is out by the time you are listening to this. So, first off, Chris, I just want to say definitely congratulations on the overall success of the Darkest Dungeon, especially with the Crimson Court. So far, I think I've heard pretty much all really good reviews for it.
It was an interesting thing. We recognized early on that we could easily just make a new dungeon area, fill it up with stuff, and you just plug it into your campaign, and now you can go there. But that just didn't feel – it felt very expected. And mm-hmm. So we talked a lot about ways to sort of take a bit of a risk and see if we couldn't layer something in a little bit more or attach it a little bit more to the core gameplay. So I think, you know, some people got taken aback by it, but generally the feedback's been pretty good. After it came out, we really watched, you know, what people had to say about it. And we did a whole bunch of like live updates and hot fixes mm-hmm. to sort of adjust and refine and balance it. It's just we're not a big company. So even though it seems to work fine for us, there's no substitute to getting it out in front of people.
Of course, definitely. And also, I want to give a quick shout to your and Tyler's GDC presentations that I watched from, I think it was GDC 2016. Very interesting stuff about game development and the Darkest Dungeon itself.
Yeah, that was cool that year. I did a indie game or the Independent Game Summit talk on creative direction, mm-hmm. and Tyler did a game design postmortem on the game. So it was kind of neat to go to his talk and get his perspective on things.
Nice. So I guess to begin with, regarding the Crimson Court and I guess fleshing things out, actually I want to start with a little bit before that. Now, the other major update you guys did, I think this was, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was this late 2016 or early 2017 for the Radiant update?
That was early 2017. So that initially we announced the DLC in the fall of last year. Mm-hmm. And then our plan, you know, we started working on it, and then we were kind of just reading a lot of the Steam reviews and commentary around grind, mm-hmm. Which is, it's a tricky thing because it's pretty subjective. Like some people will say, well, that's the game. And if you don't like that, then don't play this game. And other people will say, no, it's not that. It's being forced to like tread water or catch up to where I was after a particularly devastating loss. And it's always been a source of tension for our game, because we want you to play with real chips, you know, mm-hmm. We want the losses to be devastating or else there's no risk. And if there's no risk, there's no tension. And if there's no tension, then I think the game really loses part of its heart and soul. So, you know, we were seeing all this feedback and we're like, you know, what if we just pause the DLC and we did an update that covered off some of those concerns. So we introduced a Radiant mode, which accelerated progression, but didn't get rid of permadeath, but then we also added champion level monsters to increase the variety and and the types of combat experiences you get later in the game, so that people who wanted a more hardcore experience, you know, we were rewarding, you know, their play as well. And it was actually really well received. I think it was very, very healthy for the game overall.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that, Chris. For my playthrough of the Dark Sunshine I did on YouTube, I put it down to Rainbow because I also started to feel that sense of grinding on my last play on normal, especially at the end with the Darkest Dungeon. I know we've spoke about how you guys want to mix up the design for the final dungeon, I think, on our last talk. But as you said, that debate over what is and what isn't grind, I mean, that could easily fill a podcast in of itself.
Well, that's like saying our game's art. Like, there is no objectively correct answer. I think it's subjective. And that doesn't mean that it's irrelevant. It just means that you decide for yourself where the line is.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And for, as you said, for a lot of the fans of the Darkest Dungeon, when you get knocked down like that and you lose, you know, your top four level six heroes, that's just the nature of the game. But then you have people who they lose a hero, and now they realize I need to level up two or three more guys over the next three, four hours. They're going to be like, you know, I just lost all this time. I don't want to do it again, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, with the Radiant update, or actually, let's move on talking more about the Crimson Court. So, the Crimson Court is definitely designed as supplemental content to the Darkest Dungeon, adding in, of course, the Bloodsuckers, the Flagellant, and as you said earlier, the brand new area of the courtyard. I guess, as you said, when you originally came up with the idea of adding in new content, you did have to think about how to, I guess, integrate it lore-wise into the Darkest Dungeon.
Yep.
How did you guys go about that part?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm gonna have to talk about spoilers. So if anybody's listening to this that hasn't beaten the game, I don't know. Sorry.
All right, guys, spoiler alert right here. But if you watch my entire playlist series, and I think you've gotten everything already there.
Yeah. The game is sort of a loop, and we leave it open as to whether or not it's an actual time loop or merely that history repeats itself again and again and again. And I was always really, really happy with the way we wrapped up the game. I thought it was really appropriate. It's not satisfying, which I think is inherently part of what makes a good Lovecraft story, for example. The ends are always imperfect and unsatisfying and sort of leave you feeling a little empty. And I'm really happy with how we delivered on that, to be honest. So the challenge was, well, we can't stick something on the end of a loop. It's a closed system, and it starts and ends the same way. And how do you add to that or supplement it in a way that doesn't compromise or undermine or provide a clear or definite canonical ending, you know? Because I love that ambiguity in our game. I think it's really, really important that people are able to draw their own conclusions and sort of invest themselves in the story. I think made a lot of sense to do a it's not a prequel because it happens concurrently to the rest of the main campaign, but the lore and the story it gives you insight into the early years of the ancestor and sort of the inciting incident. I felt like that was our window of opportunity, is that we had never really explained what brought him over from being like a rich kind of debaucherous, you know, hedonistic kind of Tony Stark to like someone with purpose. And so I felt like the ancestor's origin story would be a really interesting way to shed more canonical lore onto the Darkest Dungeon experience without, you know, screwing up the balance of the cycle, because the player's involvement doesn't start in that opening segment. It's more just like an expanded memoir. But then making the content relevant to the game, we introduced this new area that I guess everyone forgot about the first time you played the game. And he's like, oh yeah, there's a courtyard. But then, you know, you're playing it within your own cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So the experience maintains its like temporal connection to the other things that you're doing in game, but the background is set before and just gives you more insight into how things got to be the way they are.
Mm-hmm. And as I said a few minutes ago, a lot of the content, or the majority of the content of the Crimson Core, is supplemental content in the sense that it's not directly adding on, you know, 10 more hours of gameplay to a campaign, but it adds more variety to the to a single playthrough in the form of, again, the new enemies and situations. For that kind of focus, was that a part of the goal from the beginning with developing the Crimson Core?
Yeah, for sure. We didn't think the game needed more length.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, I think it's a fucking long game. There's no way around it. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear or not, but it's a long game. And we didn't think that tacking 10, 15, 20 hours on the end, like, oh, you beat the boss, now here's do this other stuff. I don't think that feels very good. I think it would drag it out, and it would exacerbate those concerns of grind, because people would be like, what? I have to play the whole campaign to even get to the new stuff that I just bought? That doesn't feel very good. So we imagined it as being like a parallel, almost like you're driving on the highway and you take an exit to go on like the old, what used to be the main road, but it runs parallel to the freeway. And then you can, you know, duck back onto the freeway for a while. And in and out, so you can experience this like parallel narrative along the way without it getting in the way of your main campaign. I mean, that said, it certainly complicates the main campaign. The bloodlusting kind of mechanic ends up permeating and becoming a real consideration in your roster, and you know when and where you attempt to boss rush in the courtyard. You know, can really impact your overall progress on the campaign. So it's still meaningful, but we didn't want to gate it behind, you know, in-game achievements or time spent, you know, beating all the core bosses before you can get access to this stuff. Mostly because it just feels bad to click buy and then be told from a menu that yes, you have this content, but you know, feel like you're hours and hours away from experiencing it. And that kind of, so our intentions were noble, but then one of the problems that we had is that we made the stuff open right away. We skewed it to be a little bit more it's on the difficult side of the tier that it's balanced for. So the tier one content of the DLC is on the difficult side of tier one. So you shouldn't go in with level zeros, for example. But we got some backlash because people are like, well, it says it's a green mission, so I took my new guys in there and got absolutely destroyed. That's not fair. But we wanted to open it up right away so that people weren't, you know, upset that they bought something that they couldn't play. So again, there's no perfect answer. But I think that we did, I think that we made the best choice out of those two options, for sure.
Yeah, and again, it's always tricky when you're introducing new content like that into where exactly in the original campaign do you want to do it. Like, a good analog that would be what I see with the expansions with XCOM 2 and how they've been also going the supplemental content route with adding in these new little beats and new little game elements that are then, again, woven into the original design.
Yeah, I think that presents a more interesting design challenge.
Yes.
And I think it's more easily enjoyable and feels more impactful if it's not quite literally tacked on the end. Or you experienced in isolation, like, oh, when you go to the courtyard, that's all you have to worry about until you beat it. I didn't really like that, because I mean, let's be honest, I always come back to this story I heard about the Old Republic Online, the Star Wars game MMO.
Mm-hmm.
When they launched, they didn't have the end game completely finished, and they figured they had about 6 months to get it in place before players started cresting the level cap. And within 2 weeks, they had like a full-blown community revolt because people had been playing 22 hours a day to get to the level cap, and then they got to the end and they realized there was no, you know, end game to sort of settle into. And we knew that, like, if we just threw in a dungeon or made it a compartmental experience, people would just chew through it in a day. They'd be like, yeah, I beat all that stuff. I beat all those enemies. I saw all that stuff. And, you know, now what's next? So, you know, we wanted to make something where it follows you through the campaign so that you really feel the value and it's there and part of your experience for the duration.
Mm-hmm. As a quick aside, I heard similar things with DC Universe Online when it originally launched, and they were promising that they were going to release like expansion level content every month to, again, combat those people who are going to just blaze right through it. And of course, they couldn't keep up after 1 month of doing it. So you always yeah. have to be careful with, you know, how much you give the player at any given moment.
Yeah, they'll play through things much faster than you can create them. There's no way around it. So
definitely.
Now, part of that is on the player. You know, if you spend 22 hours a day doing something, you're gonna wrap it up pretty quick.
Yes.
But, you know, I think the onus is on developers not to play into that trap.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, with designing the Crimson Court, one of the major parts about, of course, is the new class of enemies, the Bloodsuckers, and, of course, the new mechanic of Bloodlust and, of course, quote-unquote, the Crimson Curse itself. Where did the idea of having this this new malady, I guess, come from?
Well, we had done vampires. So we've done cannibal hags. We've done our version of werewolf. We've done skeletons. The pig people are kind of like our orcs. You know, we've done the demonic end game, everything is falling apart, Lovecraftian stuff. We did the fish people. So it's kind of like, well, where can we go next? And I thought vampires were a great choice, but I didn't want to commit to doing that until I had an idea that I felt did the rest of the game justice. I'm very, very proud of how our game is. Let me preface this by saying, in no way do I consider our game to be, you know, perfect. It's like janky in places and flawed, and just like any other thing, it's imperfect. But I am proud of how we built a world by sidestepping some of the expected RPG tropes and conventions. So when I thought, look, we haven't done vampires, I didn't really want to hit go until I'd found an angle that we could call our own that wasn't like sexy vampires, because I feel like it's just not as interesting. So I started thinking about, like, well, what are some real world parasites? And they're like leeches and ticks and mosquitoes. That just got me thinking, like, actually, what if it was really like mutated bugs, and they're not, you know, they're like black flies and ticks and deer ticks and things like that. So I did a lot of really disgusting research, and I felt like, okay, I think this is a Darkest Dungeon vampire. Like, it's not appealing. It's not attractive. It's really super disgusting and unsettling. And it makes it even worse when your guys get it, because you're like, oh, neat, you know, he's got vampirism. But you're like, he actually just got like an STD from a bug.
Yeah.
And it, you know, so I like that. I like that angle. So I had that bug thing locked in, I'm like, okay, we can hit go on this vampire stuff.
Nice. So what you're telling me then is, if you guys work on another expansion, is aliens going to be the next species?
I don't know that. You know, I don't want to spoil anything, obviously, because the truth is we're looking at some, you know, bringing the game to other platforms, and we're fulfilling the last of our physical Kickstarter rewards. And that's kind of the focus right now. The DLC was a big, big push. Like, there's a lot of content in there, right? There's like new playable class. There's the districts. There's the, two cutscenes, all of the courtyard content, which has more monsters and more backgrounds than any other one. So it was pretty exhausting. And I think, you know, speaking for myself, you know what, speaking for the team, it was pretty tiring, and we're not quite ready to do like something of that scale, starting tomorrow morning. We have some interesting ideas. You know, we're just so grateful to have an audience, you know, for our game, to have found, like, you know, a group of people that are interested in continuing to stream it, that challenge themselves, people who are inspired, you know, maybe don't even play the game that much, but are inspired by the world. To hit on that nerve is something very rare and special. And so, you know, we love our game. We want to continue to, like, support it and expand it and spend some time with it, you know?
Yeah. And I, like, for myself, it's what got me interested in reading more of Lovecraft's original stories, too, so.
Yeah, which you absolutely should do. Mm-hmm. Like, I always recommend going back to the source material.
Yeah, definitely. Now, getting back to the Bloodsuckers for a second, Chris.
Sure, sorry, I kind of deviated on you.
No, not a problem. Tangents are normal or par for the course of these podcasts. But getting back to the Bloodsuckers for a second, I do have to say, you definitely touch on some nightmare fuel with that art design for the different Bloodsuckers.
Oh, great.
And
that's good news.
Also, as someone who deals with, like, heavy mosquitoes in the summertime, it definitely brought, like, a second layer of apprehension fighting them. Because every time I was playing, I started to feel like itchy on mine. I'm like, did I just get bit by someone, or is this just like the game messing with me?
Well, I grew up in Yellowknife, and in the summer, in the Northwest Territory in Canada, and in the summer, it's like light all the time, and the mosquitoes just, there's lakes everywhere, they just swarm, they're huge, and the sound of a mosquito in your tent is like, that is what will drive me crazy. So when we were doing the audio mix, I was telling Power Up all the time, like, Power Up Audio does our sound effects and mastering and all that stuff, and I was like, more, make the bug sounds like really whiny, like when you're fighting them. And they like, really? More? I'm like, more! It has to drive you crazy. I want it like under my skin. So I think it's really cool when you're walking down the halls and it's like, yeah, it's so irritating. I love it.
So that's where that maddening whine came from.
Oh, absolutely. That's where it came from. It came from me trying to get some sleep in a tent when I was like 11 years old.
We're bringing up so many horrific memories. I'm sure for the folks listening, I bet they're starting to scratch themselves and feel itchy as we're talking too. Now, with the actual like balance of the Crimson Curse itself, and again, trying to, for those of you who didn't play, I guess another little spoiler. So once someone's been infected with the Crimson Curse, you need to carry blood vials with them, and then they can go through various states from wanting blood or craving it to wasting away from not getting it. And of course, if you use it, you gain a slight buff at the cost of your character becoming quote-unquote bloodless. Where did the idea of having, I guess, balancing the different states of the curse come from?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, Tyler and I, Tyler Sigmund is the this game designer, and we sort of, you know, collaborate up and down the board on this thing. You know, we started talking like thematically, like that it would be neat. We wanted there to be a reward or sort of an upside to being cursed, as well as a significant risk. So we wanted to sort of polarize the extremes. So yeah, when you're craving, it's a minor inconvenience. There's a slight set of debuffs. You know, you're kind of jonesing for it a little bit. And if you give them blood while they're craving, they get overcharged. And actually, they're extremely powerful. A virtuous bloodlusting hero is almost unstoppable, which is fun. Like, it's fun to sort of, you know, play to the extremes a little bit. But if you don't have blood, they start to waste. And if they waste too long, they'll just die. And the wasting debuffs are very extreme as well. They become almost unusable. So we just thought it would be like a neat way to weave in more highs and lows, more spiky kind of an experience in the game. The challenge came from making sure that each state had a clear personality, and from balancing your ability as a player to get blood. So when the game launched, there was actually a bug where you, no pun intended, where you couldn't loot enough blood, or there was too much blood. Sorry, on day one, there was too much blood. Then we fixed the bug and we're like, oh, great find. And then there was not enough blood. So everybody's heroes were wasting. That sucks. And so we had to go back and forth tuning the blood up and down. And then eventually we said, you know what, this is getting out of control. We might never find a sweet spot. So we decided to make a blood farming mission. And this also had the upside of allowing people to get into the content that they paid for without one of these invitations, which is sort of like a gating mechanic that we felt was thematically really awesome and made it add attention to your courtyard runs. But some people felt like, you know, they didn't want to play the original content and keep hoping for an invitation drop. So this way they could go in, get some practice against the new enemies, stock up on blood, and then go out into the world and manage their cursed characters. So ultimately, I think that was a great solution. Yeah. It's too bad that it came after, or you know, within the first week or so of launch. It would have been nice to have that figured out before the thing came out at all. But that's another one of those things where, you know, we just didn't. We internally, you know, we've got about 10 guys on the team, and then we had another small testing pool, and it just didn't float to the surface as far as being an issue. So that's what it was great to sort of see people respond and take that feedback and run with it.
Yeah, man. And there's that lesson in terms of how your game is perceived by your audience. Again, that's another major design point, because as you just said, Chris, you don't know what your game's going to do until it gets in the hands and front of your audience. And, you know, there's that old adage, you know, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, I think applies here.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's something I learned a while ago in my career, and it continues to be proven true. making a game and playing a game are completely different. People who play games think about them differently than people who make them in a lot of ways. And that's not to say there isn't a Venn diagram with a healthy amount of overlap. Otherwise, you know, it would be incompatible. But when you approach the game to take it apart and succeed, especially, it's been really enlightening watching some of these high-end streamers, you know, play the game where they just sort of think just brutally, systematically.
Yes.
And they dismantle everything. And that's really enlightening and interesting. So it's something that you never really know how it's gonna land. Like an anecdote that I sometimes relate is when we first launched early access for the game, we assumed that we would be spending most of our time tweaking and adding to the affliction system. We thought that's the hook. That's what separates us from other dungeon crawlers. That's where all our energy is going to go. And we did nothing to it. Well, that's not true. We did a few things. Like when they refused to do a heal on a character, you just can't use that one skill. You still get another turn. It was a little too punitive. But other than massaging it, we didn't touch it. Mm. Where we spent all our time was content, combat, and the supporting metagame features. And it was just surprising. We were bracing ourselves for a big, you know, push on that stuff. And turns out it was just the right amount. But what people were really concerned about was, you know, skill balancing and trinket balancing and this kind of stuff. You know, it's really hard to anticipate what people are going to do when they get the game in their hands.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, with the Crimson Core itself, as you said a few minutes ago, part of the challenge, I'm sure that's been a major part of balancing Darkest Dungeon all the way through, has been, again, I guess that give and take between giving the player the options and tools they need to succeed versus, of course, outright dumbing the game down or making it too easy. And with the Crimson Core itself, you guys added in several new systems and options in terms of, I guess, in the player's favor. And I think this will be a good time to kind of touch on that. So I guess we'll try to start with the ones that will be the quickest, and then we'll hopefully get to the meaty one at the end. So,
sure.
Let's start, I guess, with the trinkets. So, obviously, through Darkest Dungeon, from the early access into release and so on, you guys have added in more trinkets. And for those of you listening to this cast, the trinkets are the Darkest Dungeon's main form of equipment or gear. They come in different rarities. Some can be equipped to everybody. Some are exclusive to specific classes. And with the Crimson Court, you've added in the concept of set trinkets. So two trinkets that, if they're both equipped on the same character, they'll gain a third unique benefit. So I guess to start in this section, what was the balance or what was the philosophy behind adding in the new trinkets to the game?
Well, we thought it would be, we wanted you to be able to go out and get something new and exciting in the courtyard. Because after you beat the DLC, you beat the three bosses, which are all different mechanics and reward different party comps. Then there's a persistent mission against, a garden guardian, statue boss. And, you know, we wanted to incentivize people, to, you know, enjoy and go back in and feel a real sense of accomplishment and success for spending time in that new location. So just more trinkets didn't really sound all that compelling. It was more of the same, and we could make them super powerful and naturally min-maxers and you know,
of course,
players will be attracted to them by virtue of their stats, but it didn't feel like alone that was enough to be exciting. And, you know, set bonus stuff is not new. It's everywhere in games. And we just felt like, oh, this is like a small thing we could tweak. We add some flavor text that maybe allude to a backstory for the characters. And we make the trinkets really tied to the lore of the heroes. And that way, lore aficionados are really interested and excited to collect all the sets and see, you know, what the clues might add up to for them. And min-maxers are in there because presumably this is the highest end gear in the entire game, which I think is kind of par for course when you release a DLC. Usually the new stuff is the best stuff. And I don't see, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. So that was the rationale, is like, how do we pay out adventuring in the courtyard? Because it is riskier, because you can contract the Crimson Curse, which is like potentially weeks and weeks of of dealing with it. So how do we make that worthwhile? Well, we'll give you not only some of the best trinkets, but trinkets with set bonus, trinkets with lore, trinkets that say a little bit about the world, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And the trinket variety has definitely been a very interesting part in terms of the balance, and as you said, Chris, the developing the lore out of the game. Now, another part you were saying a few minutes ago regarding the meta systems or the persistent elements of the Darkest Dungeon, and that, of course, ties into the new districts mode or the districts feature, where, again, for those of you listening, you can spend your heirlooms and gold to add districts to the estate area or to the town, which in turn provides passive benefits, some of them being class-specific, while some can be very powerful. Like, I found the cartographer's camp to be really useful, and I kind of wish I got that earlier in my play than I did. So, again, with this whole idea of give and take to the player, how did you guys balance or come up with the district system?
Well, I have to give Tyler full credit on districts. It was something he wanted to do for a long time. Initially, it was conceived as an heirloom sink. So here are some bonuses you could get towards the end of the game when you're swimming in crests or whatever. But through play, it became really obvious that having it relegated to the end game meant that you couldn't capitalize on the utility of the buildings. So, Tyler started adjusting the costs and bringing it down with the assumption that people might start rushing some of the building construction. And certainly we tried to incentivize rushing the Vintner, which yes. provides you 2 blood per week, which takes the edge off. Like, initially you're like, oh, sweet, I got plenty of blood, I'm fine. But once the curse starts ripping through your roster, 2 blood will just kind of keep your yes. head above the water barely. And that was the idea. It was just something to take the edge off. So we thought it would be fun to group the characters together. You'll notice that there's one building almost for every sort of faction or sub faction of characters. You know, the holy characters have the altar, the sort of military characters use the training ring. The house of the yellow hand is sort of like the rogue safe house. and then the jester's on his own,
yeah.
which we did just for the hell of it. Quite honestly, we're like, what if the jester just had his own building? It'd be kind of crazy, right? That's what a jester's supposed to be. So sometimes the thematics just guide our design choices. But we thought it would just be kind of cool. You could rush the buildings for the character classes that, you know, that you were enjoying playing. And it might, for repeated runs, which is really, I think, where the districts kind of come into their own. Like, if you're beating the game regularly, like if you're doing run after run of the campaign, rushing different building construction can kind of change the texture of the character classes that you use, and, you know, just slightly adjust your kind of overall experience. So that was sort of the design aim with that system. What started as a late game sink became sort of like something that can affect the texture of your campaign.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And, you know, the game does a lot to kind of screw you. There's a lot in there, and we make no apologies for it. And so we felt like, look, if you're going to save up money and you want to spend it and get a bonus with no downside, we just have to balance those bonuses and make sure they don't break the game. But what's the harm, you know, in having your rogues like really powerful for a couple of weeks, you know, until they jump to the next level of dungeon. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. We're happy to give back a little bit.
and regarding, again, that give and take of giving the player something, but making things a little bit trickier, I know we haven't brought up the Fanatic yet, but we'll be getting to him in a few minutes.
Sweet.
Now, of course, talking about what you guys added to make the game easier to give the player options, the last but certainly not least is the new class of the Flagellant. Mm-hmm. And the Flagellant, I really enjoy that class. I think he's become one of my favorites just due to his unique utility. So again, keeping with this theme of balancing the player's options without making things too over the top, where did the Flagellant come from in terms of his utility and design?
Well, he was one of the first characters we thought of before we even started the game. His name was on the first list, and we just kept punting it and punting it and punting it. And so we felt like his time had come, the blood theme was just too good to pass up, right? Like, all the monsters are blood focused. So let's bring this hero out. Mechanically, we wanted to do something that was, you know, high risk, high reward, and actually provide an exception to the affliction rule. So he can only become rapturous. He's at his best when he's almost dead and he's crazy. but he's all, you know, he's close to death. So then suddenly trinkets like death blow resists start becoming really, really useful. Whereas before they were kind of passed over in a lot of cases. And he just plays, he is almost a mirror image of the normal way of playing the game. You want to get his health down. He sucks up bleeds and blights and stress from all the other characters. You want to dump it all down on him, and then that opens up his big nuke moves. And as a result, you know, his bar, his stress bar and health bar are constantly flip-flopping back and forth, and it just kind of creates an interesting dynamic, and he feels chaotic to play, whereas the other ones are sort of like, well, no, keep me alive, steady, easy, heal me back up. You know, the flagellant is either teetering on the brink or just nuked himself back up to full health. I really welcome him into the lineup. I think we wanted him to feel special, still obviously thematically connected to the world and not invincible, but definitely a little different. And I think that he fits in really nicely with the existing lineup.
Mm-hmm. And again, like the fact that he has a different way of healing in terms of, again, like his quote unquote new heal or his, heal over time skill.
Yep.
It lets him integrate into a lot more parties than I think the other classes. Like, you can take him, and if you play your cards right, you don't really need a full healer. You can just have the flagellant, again, soak up the damage and do it.
Yeah, it's like building, this is not maybe a great example, but if anybody's played Overwatch, it's like building around a Zenyatta for a healer. Like, he's got offensive capabilities. You know, he can single target heal pretty well. If you start taking massive party-wide AoE damage, he starts to break down a little bit as far as being like reliable as the only source of heals. But if you can hold it together and you structure a solid party around him, it's pretty formidable.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess moving on, talking more about the Crimson Core, we can probably switch gears and now get to some of the more challenging or more challenges, and again, the situations the player is going to be dealing with. Oop, one second. Nothing, just a quick buzz there. Never mind. So, as we've said, with this whole idea of give and take, we've talked certainly about the give. Let's, I guess, get back to the take. And as I said a few minutes ago, one big element of that, of course, is the Fanatic. Mm-hmm. And for those of you listening to the cast, the Fanatic is a mini-boss fight that begins to show up once your heroes start to become infected with a Crimson Curse. And then the more heroes you take into a mission with the curse, the greater the chance he's going to show up. And when he does show up, he can certainly mess with a well-tuned party. So, I guess, take it away, Chris. How did you guys come up with this crazy guy start stalking your team?
Okay, so the Collector can appear and randomly mess you up, but he's threatening early. Mm-hmm. And once you master him, he's actually like a decent fight with some good rewards.
Yes.
So I'm happy with where the Collector sits. He can certainly inconvenience a boss run. Same thing with the Shambler. Totally beatable once you wrap your head around it. Super scary the first couple of times. But, you know, once you dial it in, you're like, okay, I know what he's capable of doing. So, you know, our game likes to play with extremes. And we thought, okay, what if we deliberately overtune this hunter boss that will show up, you know, and look to actively just literally kill your party members. It's not something that we like the first encounter with them, we want you to just run away, or we want you to go as far as you can and get scared because you saw the loading screen and then chicken out and not complete the quest. We want something to sort of be really afraid of. And it's definitely risky. It's certainly not, conventional game design, but we thought, someone will figure out how to beat him out there. Let's try and make him super, super hard, make him something to be afraid of, make it so that you really consider bringing, fewer than two cursed characters. So the upside of that approach means that you need a roster that isn't completely cursed, or else you're going to be constantly running into the Fanatic. So it was a nice way to sort of, incentivize people to be really careful with their quarantining in their stress facilities. You know, when they put uncursed people and cursed people together, you can spread the curse that way. So be really careful with that. Really watch out for and try to stun or nuke down the bloodsuckers you encounter so that not everybody is cursed, because you don't want to end up where you're running four cursed characters on every mission, even if you're swimming in blood, because the fanatic might show up and just decimate you. So we wanted something that you need to be afraid of and need to respect and really properly gear for and say, okay, I'm taking three cursed guys in. I'm probably going to get the fanatic. And then we try to telegraph it. It's the only boss in the game with a loading screen, sort of the only wandering mini boss in the game with a loading screen. And we do that precisely to say, like, okay, like you're in uncharted territory right now. And one of these fights is the fanatic and you don't know which one. And he always surprises you.
Oh, yes.
Which is, it's brutal. It's brutal. There's no question about it. It's brutal, and it's probably a little overtuned, and we're happy with it.
I got lucky. I only had to fight him one time during my campaign, but he took my entire party down to death's door, and they still somehow, I think, maybe one person died of that entire party, but yeah, that was definitely a fight. And again, more disturbing imagery when he grabs one of your guys and puts him up on the stake, and you see the person wiggling in the sack while it's on fire.
Yeah, it was really fun, and Power Up just went crazy with the you can hear people screaming and burning in the background. It's awful. but I love that stuff. I love being able to push the envelope a little bit, and certainly, you know, when the DLC launched, he was even harder than he mm-hmm. ended up being. So it's fun to play to the extremes and then back it off, as opposed to incrementally increase challenge, or just very slowly, even from the presentation standpoint, like, oh, well, we'll have a boss, and then, oh, maybe, you know, we can have some crackling fire, or, you know, incrementally moving forward towards an idea, I feel like is this a surefire way to come up short. So when we were thinking about them, even from a audio and visual design standpoint, it's like, nope, he's going to have a custom background that pops in. Does it make sense that you're in the killing fields when you used to just be in the ruins? No, it doesn't make any sense at all. But it's super cool, really disturbing, over-the-top sounds, and it's meant to feel overwhelming. The music kicks in, he's hammering on you, he's grabbing your guys, burning them at the stake, and you're like, I can't, you know, I watched a streamer play, and he's like, I just can't get the guy off the pyre, I just want to run away, I'm going to have to leave him, and yelling and screaming, and that's the experience we want to create with them, you know? So that you get away from the fight, maybe you lost somebody the first time, I think you got, you know, either lucky or better. You've been playing the game for a long time. You sort of know the mechanics really well. But even that story is great. You know, you managed to get out, but just barely. And you're like, okay, I got to think twice before I load up on cursed guys next time.
Mm-hmm. As a quick tangent, I do really appreciate the unique boss designs that you guys put together in the Darkest Dungeon as a whole. With, again, each boss being overtuned in some specific area or capacity, be it something like the Swine Prince set, where, you know, you attack Wilbur, good luck with that. My voice just started to die. Or something like the Siren, where she can take one of your party members, and if you're not properly prepared, she may just take your strongest person, and then you'll get wrecked by your own teammate.
Yeah, one of my favorite VODs of the Siren is this guy had loaded up a Hellion with, like, every camping buff, every single one. And he's like, okay, here we go. First turn. She's like, I'll take you. Hellion comes over and just, like, you know, starts laying waste on his party.
Yeah,
great.
That happened to me, but with a leper instead. Like, he's going to miss his attack, right? And then he just hews both my two front guys for almost full health. Like, son of a...
Yeah, but I mean, the bosses for me are another area of the game that I think it works really well. Like, you know, they change a little bit with some additional moves or additional skill riders on their attacks as you move from, you know, through the veteran and champion dungeons. But I think it's okay that once you figure out a boss pattern, you can beat the boss, that you can handle the boss pretty easily. Yeah. I like introducing new mechanics with each boss fight, and we certainly tried to do that with the DLC. The first one is sort of like a shell game with a bit of a twist, because you can't heal as long as there's people inside their little cocoons. So the tension is, you know, do you try, you know, if you uncover the Baron first, do you try and DPS him down knowing you can't heal back up? And he has some big AOE damage moves.
Oh, yes.
Or do you pop all of the sacks and have to deal with a full complement of enemies that you're fighting? The Viscount is really cool because he chooses a body and then gets a set of buffs or debuffs depending on who he feeds on. So the question is like, well, do you focus the Viscount or do you try and like burn, you know, the good bodies down? And they're still alive and they yell and scream when you hit them, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the Countess is all about like the two stage or the form metamorphosis and laying an egg inside you.
Oh, yes. And again, getting back to this whole idea of like nightmare fuel. Yeah, that Countess, whew, that was definitely a fun thing to watch when she metamorphosized for the first time.
Yeah, I think the Countess is probably the best drawn boss that's in the game. Mm-hmm. I think I don't know, something clicked for me on her, and I just love the idea of this like noble woman, but her train is like a big abdomen with all these legs and stuff. And mm-hmm. It's great.
Yep. And you actually beat me to the punch because my next set of questions were going to talk about the Crimson Court bosses themselves.
Oh, and, sure, yeah.
And again, as you said, Chris, the bosses each occupy their own respective niche in terms of what they bring to the table. And it was very interesting to have almost like, at least with the Viscount Baron fights, being somewhat of a puzzle, as you said, like with the Baron and the fact that you have to deal with the different eggs or the Viscount knowing, okay, he's going to heal himself, but at the same time, it's going to take away some of his turn, so maybe that won't be so bad. But it's, again, trying to figure out the little quirks of these fights.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how we think about it. And then the other layer on top of those for this particular set of bosses is that we wanted to take you through like a metaphor for like the debauchery that used to happen there. So first is entertainment with the Baron. The second is dinner. And then the third is like courtship and dancing and ostensibly sex or whatever with the Countess, because that sort of mirrors the ancestors, like what would typically happen in the courtyard, you know, back in the day. They would party hard, they would sit down for a big feast, and then they would do all sorts of like, you know, crazy hedonistic stuff. And so telling that story that fueled him to sort of, you know, being kind of half crazy and you know, drunk with richness, to tell that story again to the players, but set against a backdrop of like conflict with these horrible monsters was kind of a nice touch, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have to get going in a few minutes. Do you have about 5-10 minutes tops to give, or do you have to get going like right now?
No, we can do another 5 or 10.
Okay, cool. So I think with that, there's, I think, two more parts that I want to talk about with you, Chris, and then we'll wrap things up. Again, for you folks listening, we certainly have spoken about the Darkest Dungeon at length, and hopefully in the future we can get you back on, or we can somehow grab Tyler and we can have a bigger discussion at some point.
But, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I think that's something we could try to do. It's tough right now because we're trying to have sort of give everybody like some time off, but we don't want everybody to go away. So we're kind of in and out right now as we sort of rest up and gear up for our next big development push.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the second to last thing that I want to talk about with you, Chris, is the overall balance of the game. Because obviously, as we've said, a major part of the Darkest Dungeon has been tuning the player's options. And for those of you who have been playing the Darkest Dungeon from early access to where it is now, you can certainly see the difference in how the classes have been developed, skills have been changed, some skills have been outright removed and replaced. So I know one of the things that happened right after the launch of the Crimson Court was a rebalancing of the Jester class and his whole solo finale deal.
Yeah.
So I guess for the game, or like from your opinion, Chris, where do you see the balance of the classes, and do you think there still needs to be some tweaking done?
Well, I mean, there's no real way to answer that question. Yeah. Because if I say yes, absolutely, then I guess the follow-up is, well, why haven't you done it? And if I say no, everything is perfect, then I sound like an idiot. I think there is always room to balance and tweak, always. Mm-hmm. I don't think it ever goes away. I think it's a question of like where you spend your time, and we're not always able to spend our time on that part of the game. Certainly, it's very, very important. I think overall, every character has places in the game where they can really shine. Every character has limitations, but I can't tell you that, you know, the balance is spot on. There's no way. People got really upset when we did that jester change. But the fact of the matter was, they would put him in the front, open with finale that was one-shotting for 60 plus damage. That's it might feel good, but it only feels good because the game is so hard everywhere else. And you're like, I found a loophole, you know, and that giddiness is fine, but it's not something that we could, you know, that we could abide. It just wasn't working as intended, especially not with the district, you know, buffing his damage additionally. I think he works a lot better now. He's not a super soldier. Certainly it was a nerf. But if you take time and build up a finale, then you can one-shot a tough tanky enemy towards the end of the fight. You know, is it as effective as opening with a one-shot? No, it's not. So it was a nerf. But I think it was needed. You know, there's a lot of great, really intelligent, really articulate streamers and critics and bloggers and things like that have sort of opined on forums and in VODs about like what needs to be done to each of the different classes. And I'm not even going to go out and say that they're all wrong. I think what's important though is when you're managing a large roster of different hero classes, it's more important to balance the bottom end than the top end. And what I mean by that is it's more important to make sure that everyone has some utility than everyone, that every character class lines up at their most optimal. And I think that we've managed to make sure that every character class is usable and certainly verges on exceptional in certain circumstances. There's always work to be done. You know, we're still talking about doing another pass through. When we launched Crimson Court, we did a massive trinket overhaul. Yes. There was a lot of nerfing, but I think a lot of rarity reassigning, and overall it was very, very healthy for the game. It went over very well with a lot of our hardcore fans. Some of the moves, I think we've demonstrated a willingness to experiment, even though the game is ostensibly shipped. You know, Bounty Hunter's Hook and Slice was probably one of the least used abilities in the game. Now it's totally viable. It's been, you know, kind of redone as Caltrops. The speed debuff is exceptional when you're dealing with, like, especially those bloodsuckers, actually. If you can get their speed down, then they're not proccing the curse on you right away. So, you know, we're committed to continuing to look at it. Even the Vestal got a nice little bump to Mace Bash to incentivize a rank 2 usage of her. So we're always sort of tweaking and experimenting. I think the assumption is that if we're not doing it every week that we don't care, but that's certainly not the case. But you also can't, like, I think we're a little aggressive with rolling out the jester change. I think we should have put it in our beta first, but due to like the way the code was structured at that time, we couldn't do it. And we felt it was more important to just get the change out. So yeah, I don't know. I guess that's a bit long-winded, but maybe some insight there into how we think about it. Certainly, yeah, it's important. Where is it? I mean, I don't know. Can I give you a number of how balanced it is out of 10? There's no real satisfying way to wrap it up. I think the best thing to say is that we really do reflect and discuss a lot of the feedback we get around the character classes, and I think the game is in a vastly more balanced, healthier state than it ever has been before. Still, there's, like I said, there's places to take it. There's things we could do. There's skills that we could tweak. There's character classes that are perhaps too weak in certain scenarios. I think the leper is pretty contentious right now. But there's always going to be one that people are dissatisfied with. So the question is just, you know, how serious an issue is it? And what is it? And working on it is going to prevent us from doing X, but we're always looking and we talk about it like regularly all the time. So yeah, I don't know, more changes might be coming down the pipe as we go. I think what we want to avoid though is treating it like a live game, because we just don't have the infrastructure to do live ops. So you know, we're not an MMO, we're not a, or even like an Overwatch or something where it's like we can just push, you know, changes every week and add little bits of content and tweak it. We just don't have the infrastructure to do that kind of thing. So we have to, you know, make sure that we do our updates in a bit more of a chunky kind of discrete method, separated by a little bit of, you know, development time and some thought. So we just can't keep pushing Steam changes, because then it's also a consideration is that although we can push Steam changes all day long, you need a certification to get on console. And so we'd have to, there's always going to be a lag, and you can't just keep patching your console game again and again. They don't like that. So we have to bundle it all up into something a little bit more significant and then push that across all the platforms.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you said a few minutes ago, Chris, is a really good point about balancing or looking at things from the low end versus the high end. Because as you said, getting the utility right across the board, I think, is very critical, especially for any kind of party-based RPG. And I've talked about this at length many times regarding the idea of creating those false choices where something's either so good you're never not going to have it, or it's so bad that why the hell would you take this as opposed to any other number of options in the game?
Yeah, yeah. It's really about clipping the extremes. So the Jester, for instance, was just like, why wouldn't you put him in the front of your party if mm-hmm. you can one-shot anything at the start of any fight? That's like a huge spike on a graph that has to get chopped off, you know, but we don't want his overall utility to fall below a certain threshold where it's like, never bring the Jester. Mm-hmm. So that's always the tension. That's always the battle. And different people have different preferences for skill types. And so they'll lobby hard for the things that they feel like work really well. I know one streamer relies really heavily on debuffs. Like he's built his entire play style around debuffing down to the point where the enemies are trivial. And that's totally valid. There's nothing wrong with that. But then I'll hear somebody really argue passionately that debuffs have no utility in the game. So it's hard with feedback sometimes because you'll get equally articulate and passionate voices arguing for opposing things simply because of their playstyle preference. But that to me is a sign that, you know, maybe it's not as bad as either of them think. You know what I mean? Yeah. That there's even a discussion to be had is a good sign, because it means that there's more than one way to look at it, and that's always healthy.
Definitely. Whenever you can avoid pigeonholing your design or pigeonholing strategies down to one optimal build, it always will lead to a richer game experience.
And that was the whole thing with the corpses, quite honestly. That is the summation of the whole corpse debacle from whatever, a year and a half ago or whatever it was. There was one way to play the game, and now there isn't. So I think it was the right move.
Yeah. But yeah, if we start talking about the whole corpse incident, we'll be here for probably another hour easily,
yeah,
I think.
And I don't want to go back through it.
Yeah, definitely. So I know you have to get going in a few minutes. And again, I could just sit here and chat with you all day. But let's get to our final topic then. And that is, of course, what's the future for Red Hook Games? As you said, the team is definitely taking a well-deserved break, at least at this moment. So I know you can't exactly announce Darkest Dungeon 2 like right now in this cast.
No, but, I can't do that.
But I guess, what are you guys, I guess, preparing next, whether it's Darkest Dungeon related or anything new? And again, if you can't say anything, you can, you know, tease my audience as much as you want.
It's tricky because, like, we're indie. There's nobody looking over my shoulder. I could tell you exactly what we're working on right now. But by the same token, it might change, and then we don't want to, like, you know, set bad expectations or count chickens before they've hatched. So what are we doing right now? We're looking at bringing the game to as many other consoles as we can, and we're looking at fulfilling the physical rewards for our Kickstarter backers, who were, you know, quite honestly, one of the big reasons we were able to get where we got. So we're going to take care of those obligations in the coming weeks and be all wrapped up with that stuff before the end of the year. We're looking at additional DLC. Crimson Court sold quite well. It was received quite well. It was quite risky. I don't know that we'll do something of the same scope again, but we're certainly talking about some really interesting potential DLC options, and we were spooling up discussions on another game. I don't really want to say much more than that, but all I can say, like, yeah, we really love what we've managed to create, and we're really grateful for the community, and we want to keep people around, keep people interested as long as they feel like they're compelled to be drawn to the game. So yeah, we want to keep supporting the main game, and we're going to start some chats about where we can go next. But those are the sort of main beats.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess I'm not sure this will be a complete tangent, but I know some of my fans will probably ask me to ask you this when I have the chance. But one of the things I really liked about the Crimson Court would be the new animated cutscenes that were added from the beginning into the end. And I know With the older bosses, they, of course, have the stack stills with, of course, the amazing Wayne June providing his gravely awesome voice to them.
Right.
Do you guys see yourselves adding in any new cinematics, or would that be too much out of scope at this point?
I can absolutely definitively say that we're not going to do any more cinematics.
Okay.
It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. Those cinematics are a ton of work. They're great fun. I'm very, very proud of them. And I actually think that the Crimson Court cinematic is like the, our best work in the, in mm-hmm. that vein. But it's an incredible amount of work to conceptualize, write them, storyboard them, beat them out, revise it, go over the animatic again and again to get the pacing right, refine the script, get it recorded, then do all the final art. It's a huge slog. It was about 2.5 weeks of like 14 to 16 hour days doing that, because I had to get it done as quickly as possible so I could get back to the actual game. Yeah. You know, so I love them. I don't think that we're going to do any more for Darkest Dungeon as it currently sits. I think that we wanted to really, I felt like the Countess and the Ancestor Origin was an important part of the lore, and it is the moment, you know, when you beat you get the second part, you realize that this is what set him off into this pursuit of the occult and gave him his first, you know, vision of the ultimate end boss kind of thing. So I felt like it was important and it deserved the sort of prestige treatment, and certainly because people were going to be paying for it, I didn't want to pull any punches. I don't think the other bosses really, from a value to the story standpoint, they aren't as important as the Countess and the Ancestor in the beginning, or the final boss at the end, or the Old Road, or any of that stuff. They're sort of like, you know, the disgusting things that you have to deal with along the way. But I think it would start feeling a little, it would be tricky to tell who's playing lead guitar if every boss had its own cutscene. So I don't think we're going to do any more for Darkest Dungeon. That doesn't mean that we won't do any more on the next game, or, you know, there might, you know, be other goodies along the way, but certainly no plans to go back and add them for everything.
All right.
Although, well, I would love to, I just can't, I can't go into that tunnel. I'll never come out.
All right.
That would be Darkest Dungeon.
There you go. Well, you heard it here, folks. So, again, Chris, I could sit here and chat with you all day long, but I'm sure you have places to go, and I'm sure you have to also take a rest at some point, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think it is time to wrap things up for today. I guess my final question to you, Chris, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans to wrap the cast up with?
It's tricky. I guess I can only just reiterate that we're very, very grateful for the support, and it's a real gift to see, you know, fan art, fan fiction, and cosplay and you know, playthroughs. All of that community that's being built around the game is really invigorating and inspiring for the team. So we're very, very grateful for that. And we just want to keep working hard and enjoying, you know, spending our time in this horrible little world and sharing it with you. So thank you very much. And follow us on Twitter at Darkest Dungeon.
All right. And as a quick aside, I'm definitely curious to see what kind of cosplay is going to come out of the Courtyard of the Bloodsucker fight.
Oh my God, I would love to see a Countess cosplay. That would be insane.
Thank you. I was thinking the very same thing. All right, so with that, we are going to end things here for today's cast. If you missed the previous cast I've had with Chris and Tyler, I'll see if I can find the links to them and put them below. But be sure to check out my completed playlist running through the Darkest Dungeon from beginning to end. That will certainly be linked below as well. So again, Chris, I'm just going to thank you. I think I'm starting to be affected here. Chris, thank you so much for coming on. And to the rest of the team, definitely congratulations with the success of the Darkest Dungeon. And yeah, like I said, when you have more to talk about, I will certainly be here ready to chat with you.
Sounds great. Thanks again, man. It's always a good time chatting with you.
Not a problem. So for you folks listening, we are going to end things here. As always, if you enjoy the cast and would like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest for a future cast or write a piece for the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates throughout the day. You can support us on Patreon under Game Wisdom or GWBicer. Your donations can help to keep things going and add more content and stuff going forward. And last but not least, you can find me on YouTube under the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily discussions on game design, as well as looks at a wide variety of games. So again, Chris, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we can do this again before it feels like it's been 5 years since our last chat.
Sounds good.
All right. So again, thanks for tuning in to this week's Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time.